everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from New York City. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, psychiatric drugs and psychiatric failure to treat military personnel, then psychiatric drugs and mental health protocols for children. My first guest is Dr. Bart Billings. Dr. Billings is a retired Army colonel, a former military psychologist, and founder and director of both the military-wide Human Assistance Rapid Response Team program to deal with combat stress and the International Military and Civilian Combat Stress Conference, which has been in existence for 21 years. He initiated the congressional hearings in February 2010 to tackle the growing relationship between psychiatric medication and the rise of military suicides. In 2014, Dr. Billings was awarded the Human Rights Award from the Citizens Commission on Human Rights for his diligent efforts to bring greater public attention and awareness of the failures of modern drug-based psychiatry. He is the author, or working on a book, of The Psychology of Eating, and he continues his advocacy for an integrative wellness approach to combat stress and mental disorders. He will be our first guest today. And then we're going to New York and speak with Vera Sheriff. Vera is the founder and president of the Alliance for Human Research Protection, a national human rights and public interest information organization that exposes unethical research practices in the biomed field, which includes the undermining the dignity and rights and safety of people. She's particularly expert in the hidden dangers of psychotropic drugs and corporate and federal malfeasance in downplaying or ignoring their hazards. Her efforts in the past have resulted in the suspension of the EPA's pesticide experiments on children, exposing experimental AIDS drugs and vaccines in foster homes to orphans, and standing up against Eli Lilly in federal court over the association of Zyprexa and diabetes. Her advocacy has been featured in the Boston Globe and has resulted in the cessation of 29 clinical trials at the National Institutes of Health. Her articles and investigations can be found on the Alliance's website, ahrp.org. Let's now go to Carlsbad, California, and say hello to Dr. Bart Billings. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. Nice being with you.
I'd like you to address, please, the critical contradiction that exists in not only the military, but among civilian crime investigators with people who commit suicide or homicide while on psychiatric medications and the belief that there must be a motive to be uncovered. You've written extensively on the latest Fort Hood killings and the evidence that the shooter, Ivan Lopez, was on multiple psychiatric drugs, and yet the military investigators are unable to determine a motive for his shooting spree. So using the Fort Hood case as an example, explain this dichotomy that modern psychiatry refuses to acknowledge, that these drugs distort the brain dramatically and can lead to murder sacks that do not necessarily demand a deeper motive.
Well, that's you hit it on the nose. That's exactly right. As far as my perception goes, when I first heard about the Fort Hood shooting, I received several calls from the media asking me what my opinion was. And the first thing I said was determine what type of psychiatric medications the shooter was on, and I'd be willing to bet that he was on medications. And sure enough, it did come out. Now, it was very frustrating watching the news reports and the commanding general of the base talking about, well, we haven't found a motive yet. We're looking for a motive. And, you know, at those times, I just scream at the television and say, there doesn't need to be a motive. If you give somebody a mind-altering drug and they behave different than they normally behave, it's the effect of the drug. It doesn't need to. Motive. It's I use this analogy. It's like somebody who's in a bar and they're with their friends and they have more to drink than they need to drink. Well, alcohol actually is mind-altering because it anesthetizes the cerebral cortex and people start doing things that they don't normally do. How many times have you heard or other people say, he's not like himself when he has a few drinks? That's because he's not himself. The part of the brain that makes him unique, makes him who he is anesthetized. It's not working. And the same thing with these psychiatric mind-altering drugs. The shooter's father had it right. He said, I don't know why my son did this. He couldn't have been in his right mind. Well, he wasn't in his right mind. His mind was being altered by the mind-altering psychiatric medications he was taking. So there's a black box warning on these psychiatric medications, and that is not a warning that gets put there without good reason. And it says that you can have adverse effects such as suicidality, poor judgment and reasoning, anger, hostility, which can translate into homicide, and on and on. So basically, there does not need to be a motive when you're altering somebody's brain chemically. The results can be any number of things because of the alteration.
When we hear about these shootings, almost always the emphasis is upon their access to guns and or the type of weapons and how many they were able to discharge. And the energy immediately shifts to controlling guns. Almost never does it focus upon what medications they were on, so we decided to do some research. And it only took us about 3 months, and we were able to find that 95% of all the mass killings, including in the school systems, were done by people who were on medications. When we spoke with people, like in Bowling, Columbine shooting, the students of Eric Harris said he was normal until he started taking the meds, and then his personality changed radically. We hear about a mother who kills her kids. She seemed to be normal until she started taking the meds. And then they say, well, you would never kill someone, especially your kids, no matter what medications you're on. Well, that's like saying that we would all act normal no matter what we were exposed to at a chemical level in the brain. That's not true. And you, as you said, these brains were not normal. I even had once a leading neuroscientist who's well-respected in the field tell me that, of course, there's a brain chemical imbalance, and of course that brain chemical imbalance can be shown on these mappings of the brain in the MRIs. And then I simply ask him this: my evidence shows that these kids were selected to take the MRIs after they have been on medications, including benzodrine type of medications or amphetamine types of medications. We know that that will cause an abnormality in the brain. Can you show me a group of completely normal kids and show me where their brains are abnormal who did not take any drugs? And the answer was no. So they even selectively use the science. Could you address this in depth, please?
That's true. I remember the study that you're talking about. They did take people who were on psychiatric medications, and they find that there is alterations to the brain. It's not a normal brain. But also, on the other hand, they can take people and fabricate information, such as, I'll give you an example. They do studies, they do advertisements all the time. If you are depressed, call this number, and we will run studies on you and tell you if you're depressed, tell you if you have what your chemistry is, your blood chemistry is. And they bring these people, and who is going to respond to that kind of advertisement? People who are choosing the depressed, people who are sitting around watching TV, not working, just life is terrible for them. They're not physically active. So they go in and they test these people. And heaven forbid, they have chemistry that's a little bit different than most other people. Well, why? Because their behavior actually results in the chemistry they're finding. Now, you take that same person, and you have that person maybe walk a couple miles every day, and then you have them jog, and then you have them take ballet classes, etc. And within 3 or 4 months, you redo the blood chemistry, and now they have the blood chemistry of a ballerina. So basically, chemistry can change, blood chemistry can change based on the activity that you're performing, what you're doing, but not to the extent where the brain is being altered. I mean, yes, you'll get some blood chemistry changes, but you're not going to get an alteration of the brain like you will when you have somebody on mind-altering medications, such as the psychiatric meds, which have that black box warning. So, you know, there you have it. You can twist any kind of research around the way you want, but the bottom line remains these medications would not have that black box warning. And what even makes them more dangerous is they're dangerous enough the way they are, but there are people who are presupposed to having a suicidal reaction. In other words, somebody with a traumatic brain injury. Their chances of committing suicide with a traumatic brain injury are 4 times more than the normal population. The crime now is you get people and you refer them to a psychiatrist who medicates them. The psychiatrist is not a neurologist. He's not a physiatrist. That's a physical medicine physician. And he's going to use what he has as his tools. It's kind of like, if you have a nail, all you're going to use is a hammer. And that's basically what he does. Now, when you medicate somebody with a traumatic brain injury whose chances of committing suicide are 4 times the normal population, now you're increasing their chances by 2, 4, 6, 8, 2 times 4, 4 times 4, 8 times 4. No one really knows. And a good example of that was in San Diego, where I live. I live in San Diego County, Junior Seau. When he committed suicide, initially they were wondering, he was depressed, he was this and that. And I was on a radio show here with the sports announcer, and when it happened, I said, well, he probably has a traumatic brain injury from all of the hits he's taken as a football player, where potentially all football players have a degree of brain injury. Well, sure enough, a year later, the newspaper account said he had a traumatic brain injury. But what they didn't elaborate on, he was on Ambien and other meds, but that Ambien by itself, the chances of suicide, there's an adverse reaction to that. You can Google it and put adverse reaction. So the combination of a head injury and the medication he was on intensified his chances of committing suicide tremendously.
I appreciate that answer. I want to explain to you and to this audience a story that, unfortunately, the average American and our legislators are unaware of. I didn't know about this until I received a call from a person that was asking, could I help someone who had post-traumatic stress disorder? And I said, sure, I'll be happy to. Where are they at? Well, they're in the woods. I said, well, how am I supposed to help them? I'm in my office. I'll see them. I don't charge anything. And, but there's other people with them. They're not getting any help. And I said, okay, where? It's near Titusville, Florida, near Cape Canaveral, southwest of Orlando, in that area. Sorry, southeast. So about 2 months later, I was down there, and just per chance, I contacted my local cinematographer. I have different cinematographers all around the United States that I use for my different shoots. And we, along with a local person who's an activist, went into the woods. And again, we didn't know where to go, but we had found out through a shelter that there was a place where some soldiers would stay. And they couldn't stay any place long because it was a violation of all the town ordinances for anybody to be homeless and be out in the streets. So we went down this path, and I remember it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and I'm looking at poison ivy, poison oak, overgrowth, spiders, sand fleas, mosquitoes everywhere. And then we came to this little clearing, small clearing, maybe 60 feet by 60 feet. And there were five little pup tents. And in one of them, you could see three sets of legs sticking out. And the reason was that these were kids' pup tents, the kind of kid you get your, you know, four-year-old to stay out in the backyard and sleep a night in a little tent. But these were full-grown men, and yet they were all squeezed into this one little pup tent, but so small was it that half their body was out. And what was interesting is I'm standing there, I'm looking at one of their legs completely covered in mosquitoes. And all these little red bites and oozing sores. So I awaken them, and I said, "I'm sorry to wake you up. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. Could I have a conversation with you?" Okay. So they got out, and all they had there, they had no food. They had a cooler with some beer in it, and that was it. And I said, "Could you tell me about how you got here?" And they told me their stories. All of them had had families. All of them had jobs. One guy was a welder, and another guy was making $50 an hour in the steel mills up around Pittsburgh. And they all had volunteered and gone into Iraq or Afghanistan. But then they said the horror of what they either committed or experienced, witnessed, was so brutal to them, and there was no way that they could have been prepared for this. They were only prepared of how to react when the enemy was present or perceived enemy. No one told them what to do when your buddy gets their brains blown out. And no one told them what to do when you see a kid detonate and kill you and or people around you and themselves. They weren't prepared for it. So they were living, as one guy said, "My life was a 24/7 five alarm always going off. I was overreacting to everything." He said, "You have no idea the kind of sexual violence that occurs in these combat theaters. You have no idea the kind of hazing and brutality, the insensitivity, not just to the perceived enemy, but to each other." So one guy, I'll just use one guy as an example, but it's typical. He said, "When I came home, the first thing that started to happen was that I was hyper and I couldn't calm down. And we'd be walking down the street and someone would brush by me and I'd suddenly, my mind would freak out like this person was there to kill me." And he said, "I beat a guy up. I overreacted. I'd have arguments with my wife. I was impotent. And I was not being loving and thoughtful to my children. I couldn't hold down a job. My temper would just fuse constantly. And yet when I'd go to the military doctors, they put me on psychiatric meds. And I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I had no appetite. And for the first time in my life, I had thoughts of suicide." And one guy told me, he said, many times, I thought that I'm just going to pick up the gun, put it in my mouth, blow my brains out. He said, "I don't know why I didn't, but I would have easily." And he said, "And finally, there was no job, no home. My wife got a restraining order. I had no money. And I found myself with just the clothes on my back and a knapsack walking, and I didn't have any place to go. I had no money. I knew no one. And so I heard that there was a place down in Florida. So I came here." And I said, "How many of you are there?" I looked around. I counted about 12. He said, "Over 15,000. I said, "Where are they?" So they began to take me around to other places in the woods. No electricity, no food. Once a day, they would go for this long walk, about 2 hours, to a place called the Daily Bread. Very nice man runs that. And he gives them a chance to take a shower. And if they need clothes, there's donated clothing, and they get a meal. And all things considered, it wasn't a bad meal. And then they would leave, and it's only open for about 3 hours a day. In any case, the people who were most likely to help these vets were not the Veterans Administration. In some cases, there was an 18-month wait just to see a doctor for anything. But a lot of them were also suffering from Gulf War syndrome. They had severe neurological damage. One guy said, I was normal until I took their 10 vaccines, and then I was just spacey, I was sick, I was vomiting. He pulls up his shirt and says, I was 22 years old and healthy as can be in an athlete, and then I suddenly had all these oozing lesions all over my stomach and my back. My leg began to swell. It swelled so much my skin began to split. And yet the doctors couldn't find anything wrong with me, and hence I was not given any compensation or any help. How many of you are there nationwide? George Taylor, who to me is a hero, he was a homeless vet himself. Now he is their representative at the state level, and he estimates over 980,000 homeless vets in the United States. And you don't see them because the cities don't want you to see homeless people, so they throw them out. They'll come in and bulldoze down a camp. And here was the irony. One of the veterans, an older vet, said, they build a park called a Veterans Park for us veterans. But we homeless vets, if we go in there and sit to read a book, as I did, I can get arrested and go to jail. Why would you get arrested sitting in a veterans park if you're a veteran not making anything negative happen? He said, that is how punishing they are in the state of Florida. It's like a gulag down here. The legislators are hypocrites, they're corrupt, they're evil. This is what the man said. He said that from the governor on down, nobody cares about us. The neighbors don't care about us. We are left to our own. And I said, well, what about Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Geraldo Rivera and Glenn Beck, all the people that keep praising our brave men and women? What about when you come out and you're damaged merchandise? He said, they've abandoned us. And then finally, there was one morning where I was told there would be a stand down. And as you know, a stand down is once or twice a year where the vets go in and other vets, not the government, not, you know, heaven forbid they actually do something good, but other veterans, they were from the Korean War, the Vietnam War, they were there and they donate things. One guy's a barber, so he gave him free haircuts. And they put up a portable toilets and portable showers. Because you don't realize, you live in the woods, where do you take a shower? One guy told me he had to walk 3 miles to the ocean, and then he had to do it very casually. He would go into the ocean, and then he'd come out so he could shower off, where they you wash off the sand, but for him it was a real shower. There was a toilet and a shower, and that's where he'd go. And then he'd have to walk clear back. So here are these vets walking clear in there, and get their meal and come home. But on this day, they were all excited. They were all talking about the stand down. So I showed up before sunlight. I was told it started early at sunlight. And there was heavy fog. And so I asked the cameraman, are you sure we're at the right location? He said, yeah, look right across the road here. That's the entrance. And I've seen lights on the inside. So clearly the volunteers are in there already. So I said, okay, well, maybe not so many people are coming. But a half hour later, the fog lifted, and there were thousands of vets. They'd been there for hours. It went several miles, all standing in silence, and they just walked in one at a time. I spent 8 hours filming them and interviewing them, so I saw the truth of what it meant. As one of them said, my country, my government, turned its back on me. And I said, that's unfortunate. I said, I'm against the wars you fought, but I'm for you. Now, that's a long story, but these are a lot of the guys who are on these psychiatric drugs. No one's getting them off. Many of them are committing suicide. Many of them are taking drugs or alcohol. None of them are happy, and there seems to be absolutely no hope for almost a million of these vets. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you pretty much said it all. The most we could do is make the public aware of this and expose what's been going on and get our legislators hopefully to do something about it. In 2010, I got Congress to hold hearings to look at the relationship between psychiatric medications and suicide in the military. It took me 2 years to convince the chairman of the Congressional Committee, the Veterans Affairs Committee, to hold those hearings. The hearings were held. It was pretty clear on some of the testimony that these drugs were very destructive and they weren't effective. But again, on the other hand, the organizations that also showed up for the hearings was the pharmaceutical industry as well as the psychiatry industry. And you have to remember, psychiatry and pharmaceuticals jointly make about a third of $1 trillion a year in revenue from dealing these drugs between, you know, the professional psychiatry and the medications. So it's really a tough battle to get legislative people to do anything. Many of the legislators, their campaigns are financed by pharmaceutical companies. You watch a television show, and probably inside of an hour, you're going to see about three or four, maybe more, medication commercials. It's a tough nut to crack. And these veterans that are homeless, if they're being medicated, if they're going to the VA, their minds are not normal to the point where they can make the right decisions and judgments and get themselves back to normal. You know, there was a Pulitzer Prize play that was on Broadway years ago, and this goes back to what you were talking about before. It's called Next to Normal, and it actually showed the effects of psychiatric medications prescribed by a psychiatrist on this woman who lost a child and how it messed her life up. And it wasn't until she realized the adverse effects of these medications and got rid of them and realized that the important way of getting back to normal was to have the family and the involvement with the people that really cared about her and loved her. It's very difficult to do this for veterans if they're being medicated because, again, these medications also affect your ability to communicate with individuals, to have a real relationship with people. And they say, you know, you hear so often, well, he committed suicide, he wasn't getting along with his wife, he, you know, they had a falling out, there were marital problems. Well, of course there's going to be marital problems when you're taking a medication that makes it very, very difficult to communicate with another human being. It interferes with relationships. So how many of these guys are on psychiatric meds? How many are on alcohol? How many are on illegal meds? There's no telling. I don't know what you found out when you talked to these people. Were they on psychiatric meds? Were they going to the VA or were they not? Were they abusing alcohol, drugs?
All of them were abusing alcohol. Most were abusing drugs.
Right.
Every single one was on at least four and some as many as six medications.
Yep, there you have it.
I interviewed soldiers taking a dozen or more medications at a single time.
Yep.
And multiple prescriptions can be a combination of the SSRIs, mood elevators and uppers, pain drugs, drugs to treat insomnia, etc. And we're still unclear about the short and long-term adverse effects when so many different chemical drugs are taken together. There have been no studies of multiple drug interactions. And when we look at this objectively, comparing the prescribing practices done in the military compared to civilian health care, we might think that the military is engaged in a larger psychiatric experiment. And it certainly wouldn't be the first time the government experimented on soldiers. Radiation experiments on poor, non-consenting African Americans in the 1960s, the anthrax vaccine with unapproved squalene during the first Gulf conflict, Project Oak Ridge that involved injecting soldiers with plutonium during the Manhattan Project, the mustard gas experiments on soldiers in the 1940s. So we have used soldiers in the past without concern for them. And finally, take us through the usual process a soldier undergoes when he suffers from combat stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, or any other mental problem, and visits the military psychologist or psychiatrist. And what is the standard protocol of clinical assessment of this condition and treatment? And give us your critique, please.
Well, a lot depends on who we see first. If the Army has what they call combat stress teams, and the combat stress teams for years did critical incident stress management, which is debriefings, counseling, etc. They weren't administering medications. If they wind up seeing a psychologist, social worker, the chances are that they're going to be getting counseling and hopefully, you know, learn ways to deal with some of the effects, the normal effects of combat. You know, I've mentioned to you in a past program that 99% of anybody that's in combat has post-traumatic stress. It only becomes a disorder when they can't figure out a way how to normalize themselves, and that is the key. Once they come back, some people figure out how to normalize themselves on their own. Others need some support, whether it's counseling or therapy or integrative wellness programs, treatment. But the problem is psychiatry is running mental health, and psychiatry, if they wind up seeing the person or they're working closely with the psychologist, the psychiatrist, they're going to recommend therapy in conjunction with medication. Well, they're not going to do the therapy. Psychiatry pretty much, you know, I was talking to a VA psychiatrist. He medicates 98% of every vet he sees with these medications that, number one, don't really work, and number two, cause severe adverse reactions. I had a social worker attend our International Combat Stress Conference years ago, and she did a tour in Iraq and Afghanistan, and her comment was that there was a psychiatrist in Iraq who was prescribing so much psychiatric medication, the pharmacist refused to fill the prescriptions, and he went into the pharmacy tent and took all these psychiatric meds and started putting them in plastic bags, put them in her footlocker, and hands them out. Well, she reported them, but that's an example. Then she was in Afghanistan, and the psychiatrist she was working for said, "Why did they send me a social worker? You can't prescribe medication. What are you doing here? I need people that can prescribe medication." So, again, psychiatry runs mental health in the military, and it's very hard to get integrative treatment. Now, there has been some progress in the Army. The Army, about a year and a half ago, put out a policy issue. It was April 10, 2012, and Jonathan Woodson, Dr. Woodson, he's a vascular surgeon. He's the Assistant Secretary of Defense at the time. And he suggested increasing the use of integrative treatment, dropping certain psychiatric meds to a lower level. That was a sign of progress. It was a sign that maybe somebody is hearing what we're saying, but it's not enough because they did the Army MedCom policy, and that was around the same time. They did drop antipsychotics to a lower level. They dropped them from an A to a D level in terms of treating post-traumatic stress disorder. But they left the antidepressants up there, but they did increase integrative treatment to a higher level. So that was the MedCom policy that Dr. Woodson helped initiate. And, you know, I think that was helpful, at least dropping the antipsychotics. But the psychiatrist still running mental health in the military. They did keep the antidepressants as a Class A use.
I appreciate all the good work that you're doing on this, and all the best. And if people want more information, do you have a website?
Yes. Actually, you can go to www.combatstress.bizhosting, bizhosting.com. And that'll give you pretty much an overview of the 21-year history of the International Combat Stress Conference. It'll give you different topics, and it'll give you information that I just discussed.
We appreciate all the good work you're doing. Thank you very much, Dr. Bart Billings, for being with us from Carlsbad, California. Now let's go to New York City. We're sending by, as I mentioned earlier in the program, would be Vera Sheriff. Nice to have you with us, Vera.
Thank you.
Vera, we're looking at a large issue here, and just a couple of days ago, Fox News reported on the National Health Interview Survey that found 1 in 13 children from 5 to 17 are almost 8% on psychiatric medications. 81% of these kids were being prescribed psychiatric meds for ADHD, and kids whose parents rely upon Medicaid had a higher percentage of being on psychotropic drugs. According to the Alliance for Natural Health, Medicaid is spending $3.8 billion on antipsychotic drugs. in one recent year, the last year where good data was reported, 600,000 children under 14 were on these drugs, and that number has grown substantially since. Kids are being given these powerful mind-altering drugs as young as 2 years of age. I recall 60 Minutes quite some time ago covered the case of a 4-year-old girl who was found dead in Massachusetts from having been prescribed Seroquel and Clonidine for ADHD and bipolar disorder since she was 2, and her parents were tried for murder and having allegedly overdosed her. Now, the problem with that scenario is what possible robust diagnosis can be made of a 2-year-old that would warrant these kind of medications, particularly Seroquel. So take your time and please begin by speaking about the overall condition and state of child psychiatry as it is currently being practiced in the United States.
Well, we really need to face up to the fact that psychiatry is not a legitimate arm of the healing profession. Psychiatry's diagnoses, none of them have a scientific basis. And the treatments currently and historically have an abysmal track record of causing serious harm without ever having cured someone who is in serious emotional distress who has been diagnosed by a psychiatrist with a mental disorder. Now, the profession's failure has become more and more widely recognized. And so psychiatry kind of embraced drugs and the drug industry as its raison d'etre. They wanted to show that they're real doctors. They will prescribe drugs. Psychiatry has become completely dependent on that industry because it subsidizes both the professional organizations, the educational venues, academic institutions, their conferences. Everything is dependent now on the drug industry. They even subsidize public screening programs, and they give kickbacks, plain and simple, kickbacks for prescribing a particular brand, and usually, almost always, it's the latest drug that a company launches, and it means that it's also the most expensive. Psychiatrists have also helped to essentially pollute the scientific literature by lending their name, if they're prominent psychiatrists, like at Harvard, to ghostwritten articles, articles that are really just marketing hype. But they have a tremendous influence on public opinion because that gets advertised and reported as if it's news, breakthrough after breakthrough, you know, but really, it's the same drugs in different packaging, different doses, different combinations. Now, psychiatry formulated what is truly the most profitable prescribing protocol in medicine. It was called TMAP. It originated in Texas, but it was brought to many, many other states. Now, what TMAP did is it's a preferential drug formulary which dictates which drugs to prescribe for which diagnosis. Invariably, without exception, they recommend the latest psychotropic drug. It was adopted in many states requiring doctors whose patients' medicines were paid for by government, whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, or Marshals Service for prisoners, that these doctors have to follow the TMAP formulary. And so then health insurance companies also came to accept the same TMAP preferential formulary. So, of course, not surprisingly, TMAP helped catapult antidepressants and antipsychotics. These two classes were the primary drugs on the TMAP formulary, and they became the mega blockbuster levels drugs providing billions of dollars, as you mentioned, in profits for the manufacturers. But you see, psychiatry became kind of partners, and so their associations, the academic institutions, individual prominent psychiatrists whom industry calls COLs, key opinion leaders, they're being rewarded a portion of those profits. These drugs are used primarily as chemical restraints. They are extremely powerful sedatives. They have very serious adverse effects, causing abnormal function of major organs, including the heart, metabolism, hormones, neurotransmitters in the brain. And children and the elderly who fall under this government-subsidized health care are being targeted for multiple psychiatric drug cocktails without regard at all for their interest and their health. As you mentioned, Rebecca Riley, the four-year-old casualty. There are, of course, fortunately, she's not the only one. There are many. I want to mention a couple of others. But there are more than 1 million children who have been diagnosed with what is a previously non-existent diagnosis, childhood bipolar. It only exists pretty much in the United States. And even toddlers, as you mentioned, are being prescribed drugs such as Zyprexa, Risperdal, Seroquel, Abilify. The strongest, worst kind of drugs are being prescribed. Pregnant women, by the way, who are warned not to drink a glass of wine or a cup of coffee, lest the fetus is hurt, they are widely being prescribed antidepressants, despite evidence of harm to the unborn fetus. I mean, I feel that the irresponsible drugging of children and the elderly and pregnant women is unconscionable and it should be illegal. The leading proponents, though, of this completely irresponsible drugging are psychiatrists at Harvard. They set the tone that others follow. Rebecca Riley's psychiatrist followed the Harvard guideline for diagnosing and prescribing for children. What was so adding insult to injury to this child was, yes, whatever her parents were or were not, as good parents should be, the drugs that they gave that child were prescribed by a child psychiatrist. And she said that she was following the Harvard guidelines. They were blamed and convicted of her murder. But this psychiatrist received immunity from prosecution for cooperating and testifying against the mother. She claimed, now this is a professional, claiming that she had relied exclusively on reports by Rebecca's mother about the children's aggressive behavior. The reason I say children is because Rebecca had two siblings, a brother and a sister. They were 7 and 9. And guess what? They had the same diagnosis given by the same doctor and prescribed in varying amounts the same drugs. That's the guideline that she was following, obviously. There was another child in 2009. His name was Gabriel Myers. He was in foster care in Florida. Foster care children are at particular risk of being prescribed huge doses of psychiatric drugs. He was 7 years old when he committed suicide. The current case, cause célèbre, if you will, is Justina Pelletier. Justina lived in Connecticut with her parents. She has been diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, which is rare and debilitating and very complex. She was in the care of the chief of metabolism services at Tufts, Dr. Mark Corson. She had some setbacks, and he suggested that the parents take her to Boston Children's Hospital, where she should be seen by a specialist in gastrointestinal disease who had recently transferred from Tufts to Boston Children's Hospital. Instead of following the recommendation of her doctor, suddenly the psychiatric department got involved, and they determined that she belonged in psychiatry, and that she had, again, they gave her a diagnosis that most psychiatrists don't even accept, somatoform disorder. In other words, hypochondria. They made a case against the mother, as if the mother was involved in creating the child's illnesses, disregarding the specialist, the doctor, who was involved for several years, and claimed a kind of Munchausen, you know, as if she was making her sick. They got custody of the child, took away this 15-year-old from her parents. They even had a judge permanently take custody away from the parents. This is all without any due process, without any evidence. Hearsay by the psychiatrists of Boston Hospital and Child Services. Now, this is a very important case because it's going on. The judge even had the audacity to put a gag order on the parents not to tell anything that was happening. And the parents, unfortunately, for almost a year, kept quiet. But finally, the father started to talk and media got involved. And so this is, as I say, the current cause celebre. Once it got onto the major media, the Boston Globe in particular did the in-depth investigative report, but Slate has been writing about it. ABC has written, has shown on Good Morning America. Anyway, this child hopefully eventually will be reunited with the parents, but it is not according to the system. The system has done everything to break it apart, and the crime here is the scariness for all of us should be, my goodness, you can come into a hospital to be treated for a medical condition, and suddenly your child can be taken away from you because they, for whatever reason, want a body. This particular child and this particular family is not poor. They actually have good insurance. Well, that means a lot of money. She spent a year in lock-up ward, the psych ward, at Boston Children's Hospital. She is now in a wheelchair. She used to skate, ice skate, competitively, even with her mitochondria. What can one say except gasp? There is this coming Sunday, May 4th, a demonstration across the street from the Javits Convention Center in New York City, at noon, at 34th Street and 11th Avenue. And I do hope that any listeners who are in New York can come and say hello to me. I'll be there.
For many years, antipsychotic drugs were only prescribed for extreme psychotic cases. However, today these drugs are being given to children to control ADHD and milder forms of bipolar conditions. I feel that the way that ADHD is being diagnosed today is a scandal. Experts claim that about 6 million children have symptoms of ADHD. They see a pediatrician and then simply prescribe Ritalin or another psychoactive drug. No one in our mental health system thinks deeply anymore about what a mental disorder really means. Prescribing these drugs that are powerful to small children because they show signs of being anxious or depressed is ridiculous. We don't know anything about what goes on in the child's mind. All we know is control the symptoms. As a result, the child is suffering, and frequently developmentally or psychologically, because they've been given a diagnosis of mental ill when they're not. Talk about that, please.
If psychiatry had been able to help those who are mentally ill, then we should be seeing shrinking of those who are designated. I hate to say diagnosed because their method of diagnosing has nothing to do with medicine and evidence-based, you know, diagnosis. And anyone who's ever been in the mental health field knows that every patient winds up having a whole list of diagnoses depending on which psychiatrist they see, at which institution, at, you know, which year when this or that diagnosis becomes fashionable and the one mostly given. So it has no scientific basis. Children are fidgety and aggressive, and whatever part of it is being a child. Part of it is that schools now don't even have breaks for gym. I used to have to go to gym for an hour every day, like it or not, but it's certainly a good way to let off some steam. They don't have that opportunity now. They're supposed to be sitting, and often, you know, they're often bored. So, of course, they're going to act out. But to use chemical restraints as the way to discipline is certainly not progress and certainly doesn't help the mental health of the child.
When a person goes to the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and reads the fact sheet for parents, there's a list of psychiatric symptoms and disorders where psychotropic medication is being recommended. Bedwetting after the age of 5, anxiety in school, eating disorders, insomnia, night terrors, and they're adding to more that if you defy your parents or any authority person, you now are considered psychiatric. Your thoughts about the overdiagnosis and the overtreatment of our children?
But you really need to follow the money. If you look at where the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry gets their money, it's the drug companies that manufacture those drugs that they recommend. It's really a very plain story. By now, a lot of that has come out with various FOIA requests and things. Years ago, it was only suspected, but now there's evidence that, you know, they tout the treatment, the drugs that pay them the money. It's that simple. It's outrageous. But that has made, it's rendered medicine into really a business, and a very unseemly business.
I appreciate all the good work that you've done, Vera, and your organization, with the Alliance for Human Research Protection. I'll be there on Sunday at noon across from the Javits Center. Mm-hmm. We'll be supporting you and all the victims of psychiatric and mental health abuse, and also for the work that you did exposing the impact of Zyprexa and diabetes, where you took on Eli Lilly. It took a great deal of courage for you to do that. So for all the other things you've done, I thank you on behalf of this audience. The website is ahrp.org. That's ahrp.org. My guest, Vera, V-E-R-A, Sharoff, S-H-A-R-A-V, in New York City. Vera, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Null, and that concludes another one of our commentary hours, progressive commentary today, psychiatric drugs, mental health protocols for children, and as well as the psychiatric treatment for our veterans. Both are major issues that are not being adequately addressed, and certainly not at the level to make a difference. Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Null.